Welcome back to the next episode of Joint Ventures with me, Richard Bus, and my colleague, Jack Arnolds. And this episode will be EULAR Congress 2026 debrief, where we're going to look back what we thought was interesting during the Congress. And we have all picked up a couple of highlights each to talk about on today's episode. Hopefully you'll find it interesting, and we could start, Jack, with maybe first of yours.
Yeah. So I mean, very interesting conference, and as usual, I'm going to talk about cellular therapies. This time I'm straying outside of lupus. I've talked about the use in Sjogren's and a couple of other conditions, but it is a topic that's always popular. It's popular, been popular this year as well, and we've spoken about it quite a lot in the past. And the abstract that I wanted to highlight was the AB101, which is an allogeneic cryopreserved NK cell therapy, which was given in combination with rituximab. And it's an interesting therapy, but I think what's really interesting is the way that they're investigating this. So it's currently in a phase 2a basket trial. So they are using this in a combination of B-cell driven diseases, so in Sjogren's disease, but also in rheumatoid arthritis, systemic sclerosis, and inflammatory myositis. And I think that's really, really interesting, because that is something that, although that's quite new to rheumatology, that's very well established in other specialties like oncology. And they've been doing this for some time. And I think we as rheumatologists have been lagging behind that a little bit, because we have these diseases. We have these shared pathological mechanisms across diseases, but we are still siloing patients largely into these legacy diagnoses. So, you know, you've got Sjogren's, you go in a Sjogren's trial, you've got RA, you go in an RA trial. And it's not so much that this abstract data, you know, this is abstract data on one patient from that trial that they treated for Sjogren's. And in that trial, they got, you know, conditioning regimens. They got fludarabine and cyclophosphamide. They then got rituximab, and they then got this AlloNK cell therapy, three doses. And that was all given as an outpatient, and they weren't hospitalized. But that's interesting in itself. That's probably quite familiar to a lot of people in terms of cellular therapies. We've seen a lot of that over the last few years, but that difference in the trial design, I think, is really interesting. In terms of the sort of treatment and, you know, the results from that, they, you know, they had a good result. The SDI went from 20 to 4, so high to low disease activity, and good improvements in other signs as well. No real worries about no CRS and no ICANS, so no cytokine response syndrome, no ICANS, no graft-versus-host disease, albeit a single person. So N of 1, yes, massive, you know, all the usual caveats associated with that. But conceptually, I think as a trial, incredibly important in the field, and I think probably something that we should be looking to do more of in the future. You know, I don't know, Dan, what your thoughts on this are, really hard just in terms of, you know, shared mechanisms and trying to get more patients into these sorts of trials.
I like the idea, and obviously it's something new in rheumatology, which we'll have to get used to. I agree, a lot of diseases share the mechanisms and pathways, although there is disease-specific pathophysiological unique changes, I would guess. But how much that impacts the response to the treatments about particularly cellular therapies is an other question. But I think it just will allow to enroll more patients in these trials, giving rarity of some of the conditions, difficulty sometimes recruiting patients with connective tissue diseases to the trials, so hopefully these type of trials will kind of open the opportunities for higher quality data, meaning you can get bigger patient numbers, and then you can maybe research the conditions what you have not been able to do as good as so far.
I think that's critical, isn't it? Is that if you're somebody with one of these rarer conditions, you know, your myositis being less common and other things, trying to get
requisite numbers for trials is very difficult. And sometimes people with these conditions, you know, can feel a bit left behind. You know, drug gambling naturally, investigators naturally go for, you know, conditions where they can get a large number of people into trials. That has implications for, you know, drug licensing and things like that as well. So being able to group these people in this way is interesting, and it's something that you know, my work in the past has looked at, reclassifying these conditions and not throwing out these existing diagnostic labels like Sjögren's and lupus, because they are helpful. But maybe thinking, can we move beyond these in some aspects in the therapeutic sense to try and cohort people together? Because, you know, two Sjögren's patients may be very different, and two lupus patients may be very different, and perhaps one lupus patient and a Sjögren's patient might be more similar than two Sjögren's. So I think it's really good to see people taking on that mantle. And I think, you know, conceptually for me, I'm really reassured by that. I suppose I have to talk about the other, you know, big cellular therapy, which was the Carly SLE or Carl. I keep wanting to say Carlisle, but it's Carly SLE trial. So this was an autologous CD19 CAR T cell therapy. Again, very small numbers. They've enrolled 13 into this trial. They've infused 9 of them, and pretty good responses. You know, many of them achieving DORIS remissions, no ICANS, no serious cytokine release syndromes. So again, very, very reassuring data. But interestingly, in this is, you know, autologous rather than so it's a bit quicker to produce, although it is still, you know, it's off the shelf, so, you know, but it's going to take a little bit longer. So it's reassuring initial data, but, you know, it's still going to take time to produce it. You're still looking at 4 to 6 weeks of manufacturing as well. So good initial response. How this is going to fit into treating these patients, you know, what do you do in that week when you're manufacturing? What, you know, you've got 4 to 6 weeks of manufacturing, what are you going to do with the patients in that time? Are you going to give them therapies? Are you going to give them? How's that going to work? But again, more data in SLE, you know, impressive initial results, but we just have to see what comes out of it.
Okay. Sounds interesting, Jan.
Yeah, didn't feel like I'd leave it out. It's too, you know, too big an abstract. We have to talk about it.
Yeah, you can't talk about Euler highlights not talking about cellular therapy. It wouldn't be keeping up with date with the latest developments if it would not do that.
Exactly. Yeah. So cellular therapy, again, interesting techniques, and I suppose I'll hand over to you to something that isn't, so if we can move beyond that.
yeah. So my highlight is the abstract number OP048, and this was in a basic and clinical abstract session, and it's titled Ex vivo immune-derived molecular signatures of JAK and TNF inhibitors predict treatment responses in biologic and targeted synthetic DMARD naive RA patients. And I mentioned this in the previous episode, what we were excited in EULAR, and I was very pleased to see that it's delivered as I kind of expected. Well, I think it's a really fascinating piece of work what this group have done. And basically what they were looking if was exploring how immune-derived molecular signatures might predict treatment responses in RA. And this hopefully is just a further step closer to this precision medicine in rheumatology. Was actually what I felt was one of the themes for EULAR this year. Loads of work kind of looking into how we can have more personalized medicine in rheumatology. And what at the moment we use kind of try and fail treatment approach. You try a medication to see if it will work, and then if it fails, you try a different one. But we should really be moving in a way how we can predict treatment response, which patients would be best suited for which drugs. And the study was quite sophisticated in the terms that they used different ex vivo experiments, and they took immune cells from RA patients who had never been exposed to previous DMARD treatments, and then exposed them in a lab settings to baricitinib, what's a JAK inhibitor, and etanercept, what is TNF inhibitor. And then they measured how these immune cells responded in terms of cell proliferation, adhesion, netosis, gene expression, but more importantly, protein signatures. And the first pieces of experiments, what they did, they identified that each drug, so baricitinib and atenacept, created these unique protein signatures in immune cells. And that correlated with drug-induced functional changes. Mm-hmm. Then the second part of their work was that they took a newly diagnosed RA patients, again took the blood samples and analyzed their protein signatures and looked which one was more similar to ones what they previously identified, what was induced by JAK exposure and TNF. And then they divided them in two groups. And then part of the patients were exposed to the JAK inhibitor, and part of the patients were exposed to the TNF inhibitor. So basically, they can identify these RA endotypes by distinctive baseline drug-specific proteomic signatures. And it's important to highlight that in both the treatment groups, there were patients who have never been exposed to any of the DMARDs, and some of them had been previously treated, both in the baricitinib and TNF group. And the patients with higher baseline levels of a given drug's molecular signature were more likely to respond to the drug. For example, if their baseline molecular signature was more suggesting what was induced by JAK inhibitor, they responded to the JAK inhibitor better compared to TNF and vice versa. And then the cross therapy analysis showed that the high baseline expression of one drug specific signature was associated with a non-response to alternative treatments. So basically, if the initial signature was more suggesting of what was induced by JAK inhibitors, they did not respond that well to TNF. So it kind of suggested to drug specificity. And I think this was really interesting. And then they did further experiments which showed that these changes, the signatures changes over time with patients going to the clinical remission, and then also have functional effects in synovial tissue models. And then finally, they used machine learning method to develop predictive models. They identified 7 different proteins. What they created this model predicting based on these protein levels, which patients would more likely to respond to JAK and which would more likely to respond to TNF in inhibition. But this was only present in treatment naive patients. Mm-hmm. Once they had been exposed to previous DMARD treatment, this did not stand. And I'll just come back to this in a second. But I think this has severe major implications, one being that, again, we are moving this to the true precision medicine in rheumatology and moving away from this trial and error approach. And although there is limitations of these experiments and etc., but I think it just the signal is quite strong. Mm-hmm. And what I just mentioned, that in addition to the key message about what this study is, it made me to really think about why were the signatures only predictive in treatment naive RA patients and not the ones who had previously been exposed to the DMARDs. I think it goes back to this idea that once the patients are exposed to biologic or conventional DMARD, their immune system is no longer at this naive disease state. And even if they do not clinically respond on the drug alters the cytokine network signaling pathways and cell population. So the immune system is creating this new equilibrium, might not reflect the original disease state and drivers. Mm. And this just, I think, further emphasizes the importance of getting the treatment right from the beginning, the right drug for the right patient from the start. So I'm just hoping to see more research like this. I think it's very, very, very exciting and moving us in the right direction.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you talk about sort of getting it right at the start. And obviously, we've always thought about that in inflammatory arthritis and across the multiple diseases, really in the context of prevent damage, get in early on, and get them established on treatment. But now we're starting to ask the question of, get them on the right treatment earlier on. Can we find out before all of this exactly which treatment's going to work for them? I suppose you have to sort of be practically optimistic with it, don't you? I mean, this is exactly what you, Laura, has been pushing for ages. Can we have new biomarkers that stratify these patients and in terms of therapeutic response? But it's tricky to extrapolate from ex vivo assays, to what we're going to see in the clinic. It's encouraging to see them use, machine learning and try and bring this down into predictive models, whether they can, through some sort of student-teacher approach or something else, actually bring this, simplify as much as they can and pull out the most predictive things is interesting, because it's fantastic, real precision medicine, fantastically interesting, isn't it? So, I mean, I think this next one is one that we both pulled out. So I'm glad that we agree on this. And this is one of the late breakers. So this is the BBOLD study and its role in PSA. So this is, it's something that you've been talking about for a while, Rehard's on the podcast. I think you said it a few times, but this is a comparative one-to-one study of bimekizumab against a competitor, against risankizumab. So 553 adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Primary endpoint in the trial was ACR at week 16. And they showed a significant improvement. And it's really the first biologic to show a statistically significant superiority on the joint endpoint in a head-to-head PSA trial. So that's really interesting. Couple of things that I pulled out with it. The candida rates, as we've seen in other trials, were higher with bimekizumab. I think that's really, the mechanism of action. You've got, heavy IL-17 suppression. So you are going to see that. But in this case and in the other bimekizumab study, that they were all mild or moderate. There were no severe ones. In this case, there were no discontinuations as well. So most people carried on and were just treated as and that sort of mirrors with what I'm seeing in the clinic with that. But really interesting, isn't it? Head-to-head trial, exactly what you wanted.
It is. It's good. And I think it's very good quality data. They had 500 patients and they used ACR 50, not 20, what previous trials have used in PPSA. So it's very robust measure of a joint response. And then if you look at the primary outcome, then with bimekizumab, the ACR 50 was achieved in 49% of the patients, and with risankizumab, it was 38. So it means that the clinically meaningful difference was over 10%. And I think it's quite huge for head-to-head trial, and the secondary endpoint data was fairly similar. That bimekizumab was superior, maybe not statistically significant, but at least numerically it was in all of those. I think probably interesting to look at the safety data as well, comparing both. And again, there was no really much of the difference except fungal infections, candida infections, as we expect with bimekizumab, was much more frequent. However, that didn't lead to any discontinuation. But I think the other factor was interesting to see was that bimekizumab worked much more quicker. The mechanism of action was very quicker because the line started to deviate at week 4. That kind of suggests that probably it might be the treatment that works very fast, compared at least from this study to risankizumab. It'll be interesting to see how this impacts clinical practice. for rheumatologists across them, across the globe. When we talk with the Be Bold, I thought it would be interesting to mention another abstract, what was presented as a poster, POS 0483, and this was real-world study, global one, what compared effectiveness of risankizumab versus TNF inhibitors and IL-17. So as far as I understand, this does not include bimekizumab. So there were single IL-17 inhibitors and TNF. But it would be interesting to see how risankizumab in the real-world data performed against those two drug classes, what are kind of usually the first or second line use for PSA. And actually, and there was more than 600 patients across Europe and USA, and they're predominantly biologic naive people with PSA. The clinical outcome measure was tender and swollen joint counts. So they didn't use any more advanced clinical outcome measures. They kept it fairly simple. And actually, then looking at the primary endpoint, there was no statistically significant difference between treatment groups, meaning that risankizumab performed the same as TNF inhibitors and IL-17. So in the real-world data, risankizumab is not inferior to TNF and IL-17. How that links with the Be Bold, I wouldn't draw any comparisons or kind of draw any kind of conclusions, but it's just interesting to see two different studies. Obviously, one is randomized controlled trial, one is a real world data, both testing risankizumab against and other biologic drug classes in PSA. In one, you see no inferiority. In other, you can see significant superiority over risankizumab. Obviously, two different trials settings, which we need to take into account. And bimekizumab was not part of the second trial, as far as I understand. But I thought it's an interesting to mention this when we talk about Be Bold.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's what is that dual IL-17 inhibition actually over, you know, just pure a single IL-17 inhibition. So, you know, is that giving you this more rapid onset? Is that giving you greater efficacy in the control of joint disease? And we're seeing bimekizumab used a lot in psoriatic arthritis with skin disease, and maybe those things will diverge, but as you said, there's an awful lot of nuance in there. But interesting and good to see companies, you know, taking a bit of a risk and doing a proper head-to-head trial. So you know
the head-to-head trials in skin psoriasis are quite normal nowadays. They have plenty of them there, so I can't see a reason why same can't be replicated in PPSA.
Completely agree, and more useful. You know, the data that comes out the other end is more useful. You know, in the clinic, you find that much more informative.
Yeah.
I think we're handing over to you. So that was a joint one. Back to you for.
Yeah. So my kind of final highlight was about how we define and therefore diagnose axial spondyloarthritis in 2026. So I have picked out four abstracts, what were presented in EULAR and this year, what talks about the same theme, really. And I think we all recognize and agree that diagnosing axial spondyloarthropathy can be very challenging in clinical practice. In 2009, ASAS classification criteria was developed, and they have been widely used for the past 15 years. And it was a major step kind of forward, particularly recognizing non-radiographic axial spondylarthropathy. But there has been problems with those classification criteria. There has been concerns those classification criteria have been misused and used as a diagnostic criteria quite widely, and that has driven a varying and higher prevalence estimates of AxSpA. And these classification criteria have been used enrolling patients in clinical trials. So clinical trial regulators have recognized that these criteria have lacked the specificity. So additional requirements to demonstrate active disease as high CRP and positive MRI were mandated for patients to be eligible for loads of these clinical trials. And I think it's very important to highlight that we are going to talk about classification criteria. They heavily influence diagnostic process as well. But I think more importantly, they control what kind of patients get enrolled in clinical trials where we study the disease and study response to the treatments, what we are testing, and then how do we translate that back to the clinical work. And I think it's important because a chronic back pain is extremely common. And this if you use these classification criteria as a diagnostic tool, you can overclassify and misdiagnose. So the first abstract with the number OP0236 was presented by Professor Walter Maksimovic, and basically he presented the new revised 2025 ACES and Spartan collaboration classification criteria for AxSpA. They used the classic cohort, new cohort of patients. They initially tested them old classification criteria on this patient cohort, and these criteria failed to meet and predetermined sensitivity and specificity targets. So there was rigorous process how they developed these new classification criteria that have been published, what achieved a sensitivity to almost 80% and specificity about 90%. And if we look at the new classification criteria compared to the old ones, there are quite a few big shifts. The main one being that imaging now is central. Basically, positive MRI is required for someone to classify as axial spondylarthropathy was not really the case in the old classification criteria. And not only MRI showing active inflammatory lesions, but there's more emphasis on structural lesions as well. So that has the strongest predictor for the diagnosis. Some of the clinical features have remained as HLA-B27, inflammatory back pain, uveitis, IBD, psoriasis, raised CRP. But in contrast to the old classification criteria, a response to the NSAIDs, family history of SPA, and dactylitis have been removed. And then those clinical features, what have stayed, have been differently marked and differently weighted when actual points are counted at the end. So with these new classification criteria, it's really impossible to classify anyone as having AxSpA if they do not have any MRI findings indicative of that and they are HLA-B27 negative. Purely with the clinical features, you can't classify as having AxSpA. And I think that will have significant impact. And so this is really has increased specificity quite markedly. But interesting to see at what cost. And I think the answer isn't following posters, not posters, the abstracts, what were presented in the EULAR. And the first one is OP0239. 9 were tested these new classification criteria in early axial spondyloarthritis, a cohort called SPACE, and these are the cohort patients who were diagnosed with axial spondyloarthropathy within 2 years from the start of their symptoms. And what it showed that the specificity is high, about 94%, but the sensitivity is much more lower. That's between 35 to 60%, depending on various factors, whether MRIs are read by the local or central readers and etc. But I think what's more critically, it showed that 27% of patients who previously classified as AxSpA according to the old criteria did not classify, even use these new criteria. But you have to remember, these are all patients who are diagnosed with axial spondyloarthropathy by their rheumatologist. And I think that the reason for that is because MRI is much more highly weighted in this new classification criteria. So I think we are reducing the overdiagnosis, but according to this study, we might be missing some early disease patients what might not have MRI findings that strongly indicative of AxSpA. Furthermore, the next abstract was a poster, POS0190, again tested these new classification criteria in a rabbit SPA registry. That is a registry what is a real world practice cohort patients in Germany. They have more than 2,000 patients there. And if according to the old classification criteria, 73% of the patients met the criteria, then according to the new ones, only 67. So again, a reduction in sensitivity. But again, I think what's more importantly is that 25% of the patients from this cohort, again, all of them have been diagnosed with axial spondyloarthropathy, neither met old or new classification criteria. And I think it just highlights that real-world patients who are diagnosed with AxSpA don't always fit these classification criteria. The classification criteria is not the diagnostic criteria, but I think it has significant implication on what kind of patients are enrolled in AxSpA studies. And then the final one is POS1341, and that again tested these new classification criteria compared to old ones in high risk patient cohorts who have psoriasis, uveitis, or IBD. And again, specificity was very high, almost 99%, which is extremely high, but sensitivity was low, just below 60%. And none of the patients whose imaging was negative did not meet the new classification criteria. I think the central message to take away from this is if imaging is negative, patients will most likely not be classified as AxSpA. So I think more focus will be put on MRI, the quality of the MRI, the quality of MRI readers. But my biggest concern is about the patients who will get enrolled in clinical studies when these new classification criteria are used. And because it'd be a specific AxSpA cohort, from those who are in the real world diagnosed with axial spondyloarthropathy, what we are going to research in clinical trial settings. It'll be interesting to see how this evolves, how these classification criteria are taken up by researchers, and what kind of implications it will cause.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you're sort of moving that needle in terms of where people sit on that thing and sort of make. But I think, you know, imaging has always been central, but see it take a more, you know, an even more prominent role is probably helpful to try and keep the assessments as objective as they can be. So it's an interesting
But I mean, it's interesting to see it so heavily represented at EULAR, really, with, you know, so many abstracts, you know, focusing on the same issue. So
yeah,
it's good to see people grappling with that, you know, but all over it, really.
It is quite a topical thing in Oxfam world. And there was loads of additional MRI stuff as well. I think what the real links to this, defining MRI changes indicative of AxSpA, especially structural lesions. We have been really focusing on inflammatory lesions within spine when we reach the diagnosis of AxSpA of not, but the more importance is recognized of structural lesions as well. How do we recognize those and quality, like as going back, quality of the MRIs and quality of MRI readers.
Interesting.
Should we finish with your last one?
I'll finish with a common one. I'll finish with something that is again from the late breakers, but probably a topic that's inescapable to anyone working in not only just in rheumatology but in primary care as well, and that's the treatment of PMR. So PMR, you know, unbelievably common. We see, you know, enormous volumes of it in primary care and also in tertiary care. And I think, you know, for a long time, PMR has just been, you know, a question of you give steroids, they tend to respond very quickly, very satisfyingly. And there hasn't been much more thought given to it, you know, for a long time. But, you know, part of the problem with PMR is not necessarily just the PMR itself, but the steroids themselves. You know, we're treating these people, they are, you know, generally older people, they get a huge amount of steroid-related toxicity over time, weight gain, and they're in a population, as I said, that's already vulnerable to that. So I was going to talk about the Jack Spare trial, which was a late-breaking abstract number 5, and that was the use of baricitinib in early PMR. So really, you know, somebody grappling with a proper phase 3 trial in this space, which is, you know, unheard of. So 4 to 6 patients with early onset PMR, randomized 1-to-1 baricitinib versus placebo, and both of them got a rapid glucocorticoid taper. So they went from 20 milligrams down to 0 milligrams over 11 weeks or so. And the primary endpoint was steroid-free remission at week 16. So quite an aggressive taper, which is good to see in these patients. And then they had a second part where they had a crossover to placebo. So the placebo arm crossed over onto baricitinib at week 16, and they took both of those arms through to week 28. So the primary endpoint was glucocorticoid, as I said, free remission at week 16, and in baricitinib 65% versus placebo 17%. And the time to first relapse was, again, much longer in baricitinib. And the cumulative glucocorticoid dose at week 16 was lower. So just 962 milligrams, I think, versus 1,183. So a decent reduction in steroids as well. They then crossed over. So at week 28, the placebo, you know, the crossover had started week 16, and that continued out to 28. The placebo then baricitinib group, so the group that crossed over, they went up to 65% glucocorticoid free remission. Mm. And the baricitinib all the way, the baricitinib continued group, reached 78%. No significant difference in the arms. So it suggested that people who did cross over, they did catch up.
Yeah.
That's great. And, you know, JAK inhibition, you know, is fantastic in this. We know mechanistically that it works, but obviously the big concern with it has always been adverse effects. And that's, you know, particularly in a group like this, you worry about cardiovascular side effects. And they had one serious adverse effect in the baricitinib arm, which was somebody having prostate adenocarcinoma at week 18, and they stopped. And in the placebo arm, somebody got a gastric ulcer at week 4. So, yeah, perhaps not unusual in the context of steroids. So interesting study, interesting to see this. Raises a few questions. I think people will naturally be quite queasy about the idea of JAK inhibition in patients in, you know, of this cohort who have a number of cardiovascular risk factors as well. But it is good to see somebody grappling with polymyalgia and, you know, taking on a phase 3 in this area. So great results, interesting. I'm going to probably wait to see some more data on it. I think in terms of cardiovascular events, I know that, you know, their safety results were reassuring, but I think it will be interesting to see how this bleeds into, you know, clinical practice, because I suspect people will naturally be a little bit reluctant. I suppose the caveat of that is that giving steroids, you know, is hardly a benign thing to do as well. But it'll be interesting to see how this bleeds out. But again, another worthy late-breaking abstract, and certainly something that if people haven't seen the presentation, late-breaking abstract number 5 is worth having a look at and just seeing where you know, just taking it in, really.
It's interesting, isn't it? My I think the thing that I want to probably highlight, what you already highlighted, was that in the study they had fairly rapid steroid reduction regimes, the tapering regimes, were probably is way too quick how it happens in the real world.
Yes.
And that kind of probably you can argue both ways in which favor that might change the results of the primary outcome. The toxicity might be higher with the longer steroid reduction, but you might find that glucocorticoid-free remission with much more slower steroid taper could be higher as well.
Yes, and if you're running this trial and your primary endpoint is glucocorticoid-free remission, you need people to flare. So yeah, you know, to show a difference between arms. So I think that does drive, and that's always driven in trials, these really rapid steroid tapers. Mm-hmm. And it's why I think that you have to be, a lot of people will justifiably look at these trial protocols for tapering steroids, and they will extrapolate on those to clinical practice. And I you know, I can see the logic in that, but you have to be aware that if, you know, these trials, they are trying to see an effect. And therefore, in some cases, particularly, you know, brittle cases, you can see flares in these patients if you do taper with that level of gusto. So that's, I think that's everything, isn't it? That's our highlights of EULAR 2026. There's plenty more that we haven't spoken about. We tried to keep it reasonably to time. Mm. And next month, we are talking about steroids. So we're giving a full breakdown on steroids, steroid tapering, mechanism of actions of steroids, all of that. So
going back to the basics of rheumatology,
all the way back to the basics and all the way through to the complicated stuff as well. So something that will be relevant to everyone, and we hope you tune in next month for that.
Okay, thank you, Jack. See you next time.